fourth canto where he does describe these, you know, flower area lanes and things like that. Shakti said, do you really believe that there are flower aeroplanes that fly? So I was on the spot. What am I going to say? I can't say no, but so I had to say yes. So I said yes. He said nonsense. Well, he didn't say nonsense, he actually swore it. He was so angry that he stated that he literally swore it. And that was the last time I ever saw him. So, you know, we've come a long way, you know, where people will come and of course, you know, when they understand, you know, we have the temple of the Vedic Planetarium, and, you know, they see so many respectable people coming and their respectable families, and they understand, well, you know, these are not crazy people, they're ordinary people, families, and they're intelligent people, so the same things you can look into. But when you're preaching in those circumstances, very, very, very difficult. So you have to be, you know, after that, I understood that every statement I said, I had to back it up. You can't say something from the Bhagavad Gita, and like in this temple, if you say something from the Bhagavad Gita, everyone would accept it because you're sitting on this asana and you're speaking from the Bhagavad Gita. You don't necessarily have to be a really good preacher, you know. But in certain circumstances, you literally have to, you know, convince people from the ground up that there are foul aeroplanes. It's not an easy job. So, and here, you know, we're also talking about Mount Kailash, you know, where, you know, because the setting of this story is that Lord Brahma was speaking to the different sages he wanted to convince them of the glories of Lord Shiva, because they had a completely wrong impression. He wanted to correct the situation. So then he talked about the glories of Lord Shiva, and now he's taken them to the abode of Lord Shiva, and they can see that externally Lord Shiva appears to be one way, but actually if you go and see, you know, the wonderful opulence of the abode of Shiva and Sakasaki, you know, it's something very different to his external appearances. But that's the setting of the scene. And then we're hearing that, you know, in this particular part of the universe, there are so many trees, beautiful trees, fruits and flowers and birds and elephants, and they come there and they bathe very peacefully. And then there are different types of kanadas and gandharvas and, you know, apsaras, and so many different types of, some human-like living beings, but sort of a mix between human-like creatures and nature-like demigods. Very expert in different types of singing or dancing or other activities, or, you know, architecture sometimes. Oh, we've lost one. And one by one. I've been in class. So we're hearing about all these different living entities. And in the Bhagavatam, you know, we also hear that there are subterranean living entities as well, like Nagas. So they're a race of snake people. So they have, you know, they can have human forms and human features and snake features. And they can transform with it. Actually, Arjun married one such Naga princess. Was that a little thing?
Yep. Yeah.
So he was married to this Naga princess, one of his wives. And in Cambodia, there's a famous temple. What is that? That famous temple.
Angkor Wat.
Yeah, Angkor Wat. Yeah, yeah. So, of course, you know, we know it as a Vishnu temple, but they also somewhat a little bit like our Vedic planetarium. There are many temples there, and they also show Yamaraj, the guardian, the souls who have, you know, died and then being awarded their destinations and punishments and rewards, and other different demigods like that are also there. But also featured within the architecture of the building are the Nagas. And there was, there's a history of that temple that goes back, I think the temple was somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 years old, something like that. And there's a history about the very beginning of that temple. And that history is there, and the people who have sort of, you know, followed that temple since the beginning, but also there were personalities who came from China to that temple, and they also, you know, recorded the history because it was told to them, and therefore it's also recorded in the Chinese literature, and it's the same history, and that is that the first temple there, because one of the features about that is that they have there are many sort of elaborate temple-like structures, but then they become the samadhi for the king that ruled in that particular. That king passes away, there's another temple built, and then that becomes his samadhi. So, you know, the question is, why do they keep building different temples, and then it becomes the samadhi? So, going back to the original story, is that they say that a Hindu prince from India, of course, many centuries ago at the very beginning, he is going to marry another princess. And so he went to Cambodia to meet her, and they married under a particular tree. It's a very, it's a species you know, common to there in Cambodia, but perhaps not other parts of the world so much. And but even a rare sort of tree in Cambodia. So they were married under that tree, and then the first temple was built in that spot. And so the modern scientists, what this in the last 10 years or something like that. You know, they decided to try and investigate, you know, whether that, you know, there's some substance to that story. And basically, you know, they're able to detect some things that are underground. They don't know exactly what it is, but very deep underground. So they dug in a certain spot, which would have been where the original temples were. And they were very, very deep. And, you know, way under the ground, in a like a chamber, was this preserved tree trunk. So, you know, it was probably, you know, as long as this temple, which is a huge big tree trunk, which was of that particular species of, you know, that has been told for so many years. So, you know, why they would preserve that tree, but, you know, that is in history, that, you know, that tree is where the Hindu prince came. And what would happen was that, of course, the Naga princesses, they lived for a long time, such as these people on other planetary systems. And when the king would die, then another prince would take the place. And so he would have a samadhi, and they would build a new temple in that kingdom there. So, you know, there's, you know, there must be something to it. You know, that temple there is one of the, you know, one of the most wonderful structures, and so much Vedic science has gone into the architecture and what have you, and Vastu, the science of Vastu, very beautiful. And it stood there thousands of years because they understood something special happened under that tree, and they preserved the tree and everything, and that's the story to it. So they've, in one sense, that whole temple structure, which lasted for more than 1,000 years, is evidence that something very unusual happened there. So these different pastimes, such as we have Halloween, we have the image of a witch riding on a broom. In the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says that actually in India, even in his time, still there were witches that they would by mantra, fly on the root of the tree, so that they'd have a tree and some of the roots were still there, and then by mantra they could sit on that and fly. So these rakshasas, which in our time, people have sort of romanticized the story, they become vampires and what have you. But somehow or another, within the psyche of all over the world, people will not let go of these different stories from the past. Somehow they accept it. There's something to it. They want you to let it go. And so here, these aeroplanes. So we see in science that if we went back even in our time, if we went back say 200 years and somehow we went back in the past and you said to people that in the future they'll not be riding around horses and donkeys and chariots, but they'll actually be flying 500, 600, 700 people flying at speeds 600, 700, 800, 1,000 miles an hour, and they'll be able to go up literally circumambulate the whole earth in so many hours and fly 800 miles, 8 miles. And people would look at you as crazy. You describe what is common to us. So like our children just look up at the sky and see an aeroplane. For myself, because I'm born in 58, there are many things. Even my time, our bread was delivered by horse and buggy. The baker would have a horse and a buggy, and he would hide all the loaves of bread, and he would, everyone left their door open because they knew the baker was coming, and he'd just walk in and put it on your table and take the money you left and go on those days. So now the world has changed so much even in my life. But if you go, I struggle to keep up with it. But I'm lucky because I have teenage daughters and they just figure, if you want to know technology, you just ask like a 3-year-old these days. You give a 3-year-old a new phone and say, can you show me how to work that? Because children, they have no fear of touching things. They'll press anything to see what happens. So, for myself, when I'm thinking, God, if I touch this, what will happen? And so I'm scared. I can have the phone for like a year before I touch that button. But little kids are like, So if you want to learn how to use technology, just let the kids go over it. But the world we live in, which we just take for granted, and in years to come, people will look at us, I'm telling you about horse and buggy, regularly. In years to come, people will be telling stories about your dialectic. Fashion like that, right? You go out, you buy something, you think, oh, you know, my teenage daughters, or, you know, I think, oh, I'm off the fashion. Okay, that was yesterday. They changed so quickly. So, what we do in this day and age is the use of energy. You know, the scientist's ability to use energy that, some things, if you just look at it, everything is activated. So you just look at something, they do that with phones now, don't they? You look at it, and find, if you touch it or anything, you pick it up and press the button, just look at it. So, it is dealing with very, very subtle energies. Sound is also a subtle energy. The scientists do one experiment where they put a little object in a container, and they bounce sound waves off it, and it just floats. It actually floats on the sound waves because the energy. There's an energy there, there's a force there that keeps it buoyant. So, what may seem to be an impossible task for aeroplanes to fly by sound is, at the moment, we've been running cars on petrol and running so many different things on. Now we're starting to use things like just sunlight. So they have cars that can literally travel all around Australia, great distances, and all they're using is just the sunshine, nothing more than that. So within the universe, there are these very subtle energies, and the energies are definitely there. So someone may say, oh, this is mythical. But you cannot say that these subtle energies are mythical. When a lot of science first came out, people were very fearful of it. They thought it was some sort of you're dabbling with magic. You're dabbling with the laws of nature. Somehow it's ungodly. But we understand now, there's nothing mythical. These energies are there. The only difference between having planes to fly by sound and not having them is one's ability to use that energy. That's it. Nothing mythical about that. That's the only thing that stops us from doing that is one's ability to know the science of utilizing that energy. So these are different pastimes are there. So, on another level, we're getting this beautiful setting of Lord Shiva and Sati, who's the form of Durga Devi. And we're hearing that different personalities from higher planets. They come there because it's very conducive to enjoying each other's company and even enjoying sex life. So, now, yet Lord Shiva, although he resides in a place which is so enticing even from the people from very upper planetary systems, to come there to enjoy a very, very high standard of enjoyment, just like coming up to Christmas, and people will want to, go and enjoy on a higher level. So, what they'll do is they'll sitting on a traffic jam from here to Surfers Paradise. Yeah. Or the guy flying on the newfangled plane. And then they'll get there, thinking they'll get a nice quiet little spot, and there's another 2-3 million people thought they'd go to the same spot at the same time, because they're all having their holidays at work exactly at the same time. And, you know, they will, you know, try and enjoy. But here we see this is very, very, this, you know, this, if you want to enjoy, if you want to go somewhere for your Christmas holidays, if you could, you'd go to Kailash. But actually, you know, not many people can go there. It's quite restricted. You know, Lord Brahma's, you know, a little bit of a tour with some of the sages and demigods to show them the glories of Shiva. But Lord Shiva, he resides there, but he's completely detached.
Because for him, it's not stable.
Because Lord Shiva, he helps the living entities to become free from, gradually, from the tamaguna, where we identify ourselves with the material body fully, gradually to rajas, where we have some understanding that there's something spiritual, but we may think, as in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter, described that many religious faiths, they believe that according to your body, the soul is defined. So if you're in a human body, some you know, religions believe that you can, at some stage, gain a soul. It's not quite there, but by certain religious processes, you can gain a soul, retain a soul. But animals don't have a soul, nor will they gain a soul. And some you know, believe that certain races of humans have soul, and other you know, races of humans don't have a soul. So, you know, this is rajas. There's some understanding, it's a little mixed with material understanding, that there's something spiritual, but really it's just mixed with a whole lot of material conceptions. But the sattvic understanding is that the same type of spirit soul is there within each and every living entity. Like that. Lord Shiva, he, because he is, represents, he does the work on behalf of Saint Krishna, and he helps us to become free from gradually rising up from tama to rajas to sattva to the platform where we understand that we are an eternal spirit soul. He, of course, he is fully aware that he is a spirit soul, and he has an eternal loving relationship with the Supreme Soul. And he meditates upon Sankarsana. Sankarsana is the predominating deity. So Lord, in the spiritual world, Lord Narayan, who resides in Vaikuntha, so the spiritual planes. And this material world is a shadow of the spiritual reality. And the spiritual planets, known as Vaikuntha, there Narayan is in different forms, in different expansions. And he expands into four: Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Prajumna, and Aniruddha. Vasudeva is the residing deity of consciousness. He awards consciousness to all living entities. Sankarsana is the dominating deity of ego, but in the spiritual world, it's actual eternal identity. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead is giving us each an eternal individual identity. And that is done through Sankarsana. And then Sankarsana gradually expanding to Lord Shiva, who awards our material identity, but also brings us back to our spiritual identity. So Lord Shiva understands, and Prajnana, of course, represents the dominating deity of the senses and intelligence, and Anuruddha, the fourth expansion of the Chaturyuha, represents the predominating deity of the mind. So within the spirit soul, of course, all these are non-different from the soul itself. There's no difference, they're not separate components, and yet there is a presiding deity to preside over the different activities, features of the soul. So Lord Shiva, he's on the spiritual platform. He knows that there's a spirit soul. There's nothing that he requires in the spiritual, in the material world. There's nothing. He can, you know, be here for many, many pastimes, practically since time immemorial. There's nothing to gain, there's nothing to lose. He's a spirit soul, there is absolutely nothing there in the material world. It is completely something superfluous. It is not required by the spirit soul. We don't need the material energy in order to live. We don't need material to exist. We don't need material energy in order to be happy. I think someone asked, what would happen if everyone went back to the spiritual world? Because that's what we're trying to do. There'd be no need for the material world. Yes, exactly. That's right. That's actually what we want. We don't need it. So he is completely detached, although he resides in this very wonderful abode. Lord Shiva, he also has a form as Gopeshwara, where he is able to relish the very pure, loving pastime of the personality of Godhead and the various residents of the spiritual world who are manifested now by the spiritual energy of the personality of Godhead. So, it's that, and just like we also see in Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, he had this wonderful treasure of love for God. And therefore, although he could travel all over the world, he had, people could offer him whatever. He was not interested in anything. The only thing he required is to use that for Krishna. I'm not attracted to enjoy it, to possess it, because having love of God, and this is what we learn from Srila Prabhupada, that if we can have the happiness that's in his heart, then there's really, there's nothing in all the material universes that actually could attract us. If we have just, we have just a pinch of that love of God, which is what the soul really yearns for. But you can go to these heavenly abodes, but that pure love that the heart desires, you not find there. That is found within bhakti. That is, we've lost another one. That is found within bhakti. That is what Srila Prabhupada showed us, that you strive for love of God, and if you achieve this ecstatic love of God, then you'll be eternally happy, eternally blissful, and there'll be no difficulty in this world that can disturb you, and there'll be nothing, no enticements that can attract you. As you describe that a little bit in the Bhagavad Gita. And of course, that also is non-mythical, because everyone in this world knows that, you can have all the wealth, you can have, so much fame, you can have so much opulence, and even offering happiness. We do not see wealthy people know, people enjoying all the different material facilities of this world becoming happy. What we see is that they increase their level of anxiety very, very significantly. And the more they struggle to fulfill the material desires, the more they suffer. That's what we actually see. That is a fact. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, chapter 6, chapter 6, text 20 to 23. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless, transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. Thank you for sticking around.
Location of Kailash.
What's that?
Location.
Local of Kailash. Oh, where is it?
Where is Kailash?
Yeah, it's from memory, that's sort of down the bottom part of Mount Meru, isn't it? You know, sort of, there are, you have Mount Meru in the centre, Chandrabhi, there are nine different paths, and from memory, one part down at the bottom, you know, sort of surrounding Mount Meru at the bottom, and one part Kailash from memory.
We're obviously within the material universe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yes, it is, yeah. You know, as with Vishnu, even Brahma, even Indra and Yamaraj, they do have, you know, both in different parts of the universe, depending on what they're doing. So, you know, at the top of Mount Meru, there are both of Indra and Yama and different demigods, but then, you know, Yama also has an abode down at the bottom of the universe. So, depending on what they're doing, you know, what may be their place of, you know, relaxation and home, you know, other places may be their place where they interact with the personality of Godhead more so, other places may be their place of, you know, carrying out the function that they perform within the universe. So, you know, and sometimes, you know, those different places can sometimes go by the same name and sometimes they will have different names, but I think as far as I understand, this part is down at the bottom of some of the but they do have other places.
With Brahma to the demigods too.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you so much for your time.
Sí, 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 sí